Our call to worship is by Heather K. Janules. From the power of our memory and history, with high hopes for the days that lie ahead, we gather to craft the destiny we share with one another. We gather with faith in the practice of our principles. We gather with hearts and minds open to the wisdom in every voice among us. In our gathering, may we dream and design a bold future. May we bring our best selves to this service. And may we dream these dreams and do this work with love. We light our chalice in celebration that this faith is a faith that embraces all, regardless of creed, of gender, of sexual orientation, race, physical ability, or a multitude of other variables in our bodies and our lives. May we be blessed by this container, this faith, this church that holds us all. This is our new member Sunday. We hold these twice a year following our four-week UU journey at FPC class. And that doesn't mean that this is the only time of year you can join. We have people who join throughout the year in private signing ceremonies, and also sometimes people choose that because they are, like me, an introvert and don't want to stand in front of the congregation. Not that I don't want to stand in front of the congregation. I do. But it took me many years of work to get over my nerves about that. So our ceremony has a few parts. First, we invite people to sign the book, and then we're going to do a little responsive reading that's in your orders of service. You can be pulling that out. And then the third part after we do the little ceremony is we have some welcome items for our new members. In those welcome bags, our new members will find some little things that Jolene has pulled together to welcome them to our church. And there are five small rocks in the bags. Those aren't just to weigh it down. Those five smooth stones stand for the five smooth stones of religious liberalism, which is an essay written by Unitarian theologian James Luther Adams. James Luther Adams used the metaphor of five smooth stones, which comes from the five smooth stones that were in David's pouch when he fought Goliath in his slingshot. And these are the five rocks on which we build our faith. They are, first, that religious liberalism depends upon the principle that revelation is continuous. So we are a living tradition, always open to new truths. Second, that we freely choose to enter into relationship together, that our faith is built on free and mutual consent, not on coercion. Third, James Luther Adams says, religious liberalism affirms the moral obligation to direct one's effort towards the establishment of a just and loving community. And so we are a faith that is committed to works of justice. And fourth, we deny the immaculate conception of virtue and affirm the necessity of social incarnation. In other words, we have agency. Good things don't just happen. We make them happen in our faith. And lastly, the last smooth stone is that liberalism holds that the resources, divine and human, are available for the achievement of meaningful change, and that this justifies an attitude of ultimate optimism. So we have hope. So a free and open faith in a learning tradition, that we have a mutual consent and not coercion. We believe in justice and agency and hope. May these be rocks upon which we all come together in this faith. Our words for prayer or meditation come from Barbara Merritt. Barbara was the senior minister of the UU Church in Worcester until her retirement. They're titled, Love Knows You. When my youngest child was a baby, the sweetest part of my day was putting David to sleep. At 15 months, he had a demanding schedule. There were toilet paper rolls to unravel, dressers to empty, bookshelves to clear, trash baskets to dump on the floor, papers to tear, pots and pans to bang, books to redistribute throughout the house and office, pigeons to chase in the park, food to massage into his hair, a brother's toys to covet and fight for, and a considerable collection of bright and educational playthings to utterly ignore. By 7:30 at night, little David was stumbling through the house like a drunken sailor, cranky, exhausted, and too tired to walk in a straight line. But when I warmed a bottle of milk and he climbed up into my lap, the transformation was nothing short of miraculous. He would start to drink his bottle, and all the tension and agitation would melt away from his face. As he nestled into my arms, the frantic energy and frustration disappeared. His little body relaxed. He started to smile and to hum to himself, and in a few minutes he was asleep. As the look of peace came over him, I found myself feeling wonderfully peaceful as well. Most little children find a place of comfort, safety, and nourishment and love in their mothers and fathers and parents' arms. It's the place to go after a long, hard day, a reality they can trust. Again and again, they return to this sustaining relationship. Independence is fine. There will be more mischief and exploration tomorrow. But babies seem to instinctively sense how important it is to recharge their batteries and to allow someone stronger to take care of them. I suspect that meditation and prayer are motivated by the same instinct. In our prayers, we are nestling in with reality, adopting a stance that declares that we trust what is out there and what is inside. In moments of meditation, we assume a certain confidence, a faith that what is ultimately friendly, capable of supporting our life, and able to restore us to our full strength and potential. In a posture of receptivity and dependency, we allow for the possibility that a greater power than ourselves will hold us, feed our starving souls, and give us peace. Our best prayers are when we can simply turn our faces in the direction of love. One of my favorite Buddhist prayers reads in part, "You may come to this love for a few seconds, then go away and do whatever you will. God's love is unchanging. You may deny the power of love to yourself, then curse God to anyone who will listen. God's love is unchanging. You may become the most despised of creatures, then return. Love is unchanging. Go where you will. Do whatever you will, stay however long you will, and come back. This love is unchanging. No matter what befalls, no matter what you become, love awaits you always. Love knows you and serves you. Love, God's love for you in an unchanging world, in a changing world, is unchanging." This is National Adoption Awareness Month, and I wanted to celebrate it today. But before I do that, I wanted to share some things with you. Because when I've talked with parents who have adopted some children in their lives, one of the things that they want to talk about first with me is what's in the not to say category. It's risky to have someone talking about this from the pulpit because, you see, even in Unitarian Universalism, we can say some things that aren't so very thoughtful sometimes or just unthinking. And there are sometimes things that seem really lovely to say but are heard very differently in adoptive communities. And so we have a number of families in this church who have adopted children into their lives, and so it's good for us to get some basic training on how we talk about that. And in doing so, I recognize that I probably will make mistakes all through this sermon, and I beg your apology for that. So here's a few things. First, it's best practice to use the word adopted as a verb and not as an adjective when talking about children. Families adopt children, but they don't call their children adopted children. They're just children. These families love their children and care for their children like all other families. They don't think of their children as my adopted child. This is just my child. And so just as that's the language they would use, that's the language we all should use for these children. Second, particularly for parents, for children who are non-white children living in a largely white culture, this world can be full of microaggressions. Please do not, and I say this to myself as well, do not touch children's hair or skin to feel it without permission. You don't really need to do so unless you're like shaking a child's hand in a ritual, or if a kid gets glue stuck in their hair in religious education, you can do something about that. But before we touch other people's bodies, it's always good to ask permission. I'm a tactile person. I know that sometimes something looks interesting and you just want to feel it, but we try to keep that in check when it's other people's bodies. So we say, may I help you get that gum or glue out of your hair, please? Third, and this is what I know from being a foster parent, and particularly with children, with parents of foster children, but also parents who have adopted children, we should try not to say, they are so lucky to have you. I know what's meant by this, and it's really well-meaning, right? What you mean, what we mean, what I mean when I say this is, you're a wonderful parent, and you're really great at parenting, and I think you're a great person. And those things are pretty much always good to say to people. But when we say, they're so lucky, it can feel like we're ignoring the hardship that a child may have gone through. And even worse, it sounds like a child maybe doesn't deserve a loving, caring family and only gets one through luck. It's not what is meant, but it's sometimes what is felt and received. So this is also something we say that, like calling a child an adopted child, makes families feel different. We don't say this to biologically produced families. We don't say, they're so lucky to have you. I've never been told, my child is so lucky to have you, I don't think. So let's not do that to parents who adopt children. If we want to say you're a great parent, saying just that will do. Another one is that it's best not to ask about birth parents. Many parents who have children who they have adopted believe that this story around their birth parents is their child's story to tell when they're old enough and if they're ready to do so and if they choose to do so. It is not theirs to tell for the child. So I know the reason people ask is because they want to show interest and acceptance and to start a conversation. One way to do that might be to say, are there parts of your adoption story that you enjoy telling? That gives the parents permission to say, no, it's all very sensitive. Or, yeah, there's a part of this story that's like a lot of fun to tell, and let me tell you about it. Choosing to open a conversation with something that may touch on sensitive points of pain and loss is not an opening conversation, right? That's a conversation we save for when we know people a lot better before we poke around in the painful parts of other people's narratives. So while I'm talking mostly about adoption today, as a parent, a former parent of foster children, I'll add in one more, since I know that some children who have been in foster care, and see, this is where I'm doing it a lot myself. I'm saying foster children, adopted children, even though it's better to say children who experienced this in their lives. But we know that most, if not all, children who have been placed in foster care have an experience of trauma. Because even if they didn't experience trauma in their home, being removed from their home is a traumatic experience. So being removed is hard on a kid and sometimes harder than what they were dealing with in the home. And having seen up close what that removal, the removal alone can do to a child, and that trauma is just from that alone sometimes even, I'm not surprised to be telling you that foster children are twice as likely to have post-traumatic stress disorder as veterans returning from war. Because children in foster care, children who have been placed in foster care, are nearly universally traumatized by this experience. And kids with trauma experiences will react different and experience different things from what may seem like ordinary and innocuous actions. So an example, to say withholding food as punishment or reward, to say, I'm not going to give you this food until you do this, is experienced very differently sometimes to a child who has experienced trauma around food. Children, raising your voice similarly can be a trigger. So if you're working with foster children, and those of us who work with children never know if we are working with children who may have been placed into foster care or whether we will be at any given time, it's always good to do some reading on how children with trauma experience things differently and to learn a little bit more about that. So, just some ground rules about how we talk in community. And the reason I want to talk about this is because our community experiences these interactions a lot. It's my theory that Unitarian Universalism is a faith much more touched by adoption than is the general population. And I can't prove this for our faith as a whole because nobody does statistics on this. It's not the case that in any, or the average Unitarian Universalist Sunday school enrollment form, it will ask you much of anything about demographic information other than your name and address and parents' names and allergies. We don't say, did you get your vaccinations? We don't say a lot of other things. So I have only anecdotal information about the churches I've served to prove this, but it feels really true, and I know it's true here. So let me walk you through it. It turns out that in all of the U.S., all the children in the United States, 2.5% are adopted children, children who are adopted, 2.5%. Nationally, of all children. So that means out of every 120 children, you would expect three of them to be children who have been adopted. That number, 120, is very close to the number of our church school enrollment, which is 115. So you'd expect to have three children in our religious education program who are children who have been adopted. Do you think we have more than that? Oh, yes, we do. We have, I don't know the numbers, because again, we don't keep those statistics, but we have more than double that. So, so that's significant, right? In my previous church, it was easier for me to count, because first of all, we had fewer children, and secondly, I had known some of them all of their lives, and so I knew the stories of all of these families in the church. Statistically, in that church, there should have been less than one child in that congregation who was a child who had been adopted. Instead, we had a program where there was a full one-third of the children who were adopted. So my theory is there's something about Unitarian Universalism that encourages adoption, or something about Unitarian Universalism that attracts people who have adoption in their family narratives. Perhaps both. So what might that be? There's some demographic factors we have that might explain this. We are a population that includes a lot of LGBT parents, and they may have higher adoption rates. Adoption is also more frequent in adults over 30, and so the fact that we're a more educated population than the average population may mean that we defer childbearing more often, and then more often turn to adoption to build our families. And we are also a population on the whole in Unitarian Universalism that is wealthier than the average population, and adoption costs money. So though those demographic factors and other demographic factors may be part of why we see this phenomenon in Unitarian Universalism. But when I look back at my previous congregation, that doesn't really explain it. It wasn't my LGBT people actually in that congregation who had adopted. And that congregation was largely a working class congregation, and it was a congregation without a much older parent age than the average population. So I think there's something that's more than demographics to this. What I want to celebrate today is that I think there are Unitarian Universalist values that are why we see this phenomenon in our congregations. And so I want to celebrate those values of Unitarian Universalism that we hold dear and celebrate these families today. The first value that I see goes back to that demographic information. We're a church that welcomes people of all sexual orientations and gender identities. And we're a church that has made very active and public stances on issues of anti-racism and anti-oppression as well. And I think that when people see this from outside our church, they know that whatever their family's structure, whether that's because they're an LGBT family or because they have a cross-racial or cross-cultural adoption, they're going to be welcome here. So our radical love and hospitality for every group that we've publicly declared it for helps us be known to the world as a place of radical love and acceptance and hospitality. We're a welcoming church in multiple ways. So for families that have adopted, our commitment to diversity and inclusion is important. They need a religious community that will protect them, advocate for them, and embrace them with a fierce love and a fierce commitment. And they find that in this faith. Another issue that we have been engaged in as a effect of being engaged in the fight for LGBT rights and marriage equality was that we were also engaged in the adoption fight. We were standing for the rights of same-sex couples to be treated as loving parents that they are and to be able to adopt a child. In fighting for adoption rights, we signaled our friendliness to adoptive families at some level. The next value I see is very closely related, which is our value in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. We are a faith that says every person, and that includes every child, is worthy, is important, is deserving of love and of a good home, is deserving of food and shelter and of nurture and caring. This may seem ridiculously obvious to people of this church. Like, of course, we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of all people. But this is not a universally held belief in our culture. Our strong belief in nurture over nature, our belief, our theological perspective that says all souls are ultimately saved, regardless of the circumstances of your birth or of your life, those theological perspectives lead some people to this faith, and the opposite leads people away. Our belief ultimately leads us to know that love makes a family. Love is stronger than biology, stronger than genetics, stronger, much stronger than the forces of hate. So our embrace of diversity and our love for different cultures and different beliefs is related to this, and part of what makes us an attractive place for families with transracial and cross-cultural adoptions, which is a kind of adoption you'll see a lot in Unitarian Universalist circles. While our community is largely white and out of a particular New England colonial Protestant tradition, we celebrate and lift up other cultures and other beliefs, incorporating them into our worship and our religious education. Now, whatever values I can identify in liberal religion that make adoption more prevalent, it all comes down to the most important value of all, that what we have here is our welcome, our community, our way of making people feel that they belong. And we will mess up, as we sometimes do, like with some of those statements I shared earlier. But the most important value here is treating people like they belong here, that they are welcome here, and that we have in abundance. So right now, for whatever reasons we have, we've created a space, a place where you feel at home, where this faith helps nurture your children and support your family, where you feel that you aren't othered and are treated the same as everyone else, whether that's because of your family structure or your religion or your physical ability or your race or your gender identity or sexual orientation. What's important here is that we have a religious home where love makes us family. May it be so. Just as we have many families in this church who have children that they have adopted into their lives, we have adults who were themselves adopted, and adults who have had siblings who were adopted into their families, and adults who were birth parents for children who were adopted. For everyone whose lives have been touched in any way, we celebrate you today. If there are points in your lives that shine more brightly that love more deeply, that are held more truly, because this is part of your story. I want to invite you to come forward, if you wish, and light a candle in celebration and in love on our table here today. May we go forth bringing with us what peace, joy, love, and hope we have found here in this gathered community. And may it be with us and abide in us and around us until we are together again. Amen. Thank you.